I'm Daniel Vitalis of DanielVitalis.com, and you are listening to the Rewild Yourself podcast, a show dedicated to transcending human domestication, activating our invincible genetic health, and uncovering our true potential. In each episode, we explore the many aspects of the rewilding lifestyle for better health, fitness, and a more rich and fulfilling life. Rewild yourself. Engage your biology. Rewild Yourself is brought to you by SirThrival.com. SirThrival is a leading nutritional supplement and metafoods company that supplies essential formulas and ingredients for the rewilding lifestyle. Go to SirThrival.com to find a line of products that promote vigorous health, adaptation, and recovery, and help to unlock our epigenetic potential. SirThrival, why just survive when you could thrive? Welcome back to the Rewild Yourself podcast. Great to be back here with you. I'm excited about the call that I just recorded with our guest today, and I'll tell you about that in a second. Before I do, I want to encourage you to head over to DanielVitalis.com, go to my coming events page, and have a look at the event I'll be doing in October, the 11th through the 16th in Rhinebeck, New York. I would love if you came out there for this event. I'm calling it Elementary School or E-School, which is just kind of my way of kind of poking fun at what we all went to, so-called elementary school when we were kids, more of like a kind of prison camp indoctrination, if you ask me, but no talk of the elements. And that's really how I like to structure the curriculum that I've put together, is based on the four elements. And so this will be an immersion into a set of ideas that help you to develop personalized strategies for how you're going to live your life with these rewilding principles in mind. We're going to look at Earth as food, and we're going to explore your personalized food strategy, how you're going to approach food in your day-to-day life, and also how you're going to approach, you know, food when you're migratory, when you're traveling, when you're on the move, because it's different. And you need a strategy for that, or else you're going to end up kind of defaulting to whatever it is that you do. We're going to do the same thing with water. We're going to do the same thing with air, atmosphere. I think it's really important that every person I get in contact with, that I get a few minutes with, that I can teach them or share with them ideas or principles or ideas of how they can change the atmosphere in their lives. The atmosphere, literally the air that they breathe, because we're all in control of the atmosphere in our homes and our offices, and we can actually make shifts and changes and adjustments. And we're going to look at fire, and that's a really comprehensive thing. We're going to look at fire, you know, historically, how humans create fire and how the mastery of fire has helped us to develop the technologies we have today. We're going to look at modern technology as a form of fire because, I mean, it is quite literally run on this electromagnetic energy of fire. And we're going to be looking at the light from the sun, the great fire in the sky, and how we work with that to optimize our health as well. In addition to all that, we're going to be doing lots of movement stuff. So we're going to be taking a lot of the movement principles I've shared here on the show and in my writing, and we're going to be applying that as well and developing strategies for mobility and movement in our day-to-day life. So it's going to be a very comprehensive five-day workshop, and the amenities up at the Omega Wellness Center are awesome. So there are saunas there. There's daily classes if you want to be taking movement classes, let's say, things like that. That's all there. There's gardens on grounds where a lot of the food that we're going to be eating is going to be coming from. So just a really cool place, really cool setting, and we're going to be a group of really cool people getting together to explore some ancient but also strangely really cutting-edge stuff. So again, Omega Wellness Center, that's elementary school, the 11th through 16th of October, 2015. Okay, today's call is with, today's interview is with James Earls, author of Born to Walk, Myofascial Efficiency and the Body in Movement. James is involved with the structural integration people, particularly Tom Myers, the creator of Anatomy Trains. If you're not familiar with Tom's work or Anatomy Trains, and you're into movement, you're into body work, you're into fitness of some kind, you're into mobility, any of those kind of things, you want to check out Tom Myers' works, and hopefully we'll get him on the show at some point. He is kind of local to me, actually, in the New England area. His work is amazing. I've been a fan for many, many years. In fact, I did my first workshop with Tom back over a decade ago, and have been a big, big proponent of his work since then. James works along with Tom and put his specific focus into walking, into bipedalism. And I was really excited to talk to him about walking. And in fact, he brings some things to light about why human beings made the decision to leave the quadrupedal life of most apes, the brachiating life of most apes, to start walking upright. And there's some really cool realizations that came during this conversation for me. This work is, if you're not from the bodywork community, and just as a little background on me, I worked 5 years as a massage therapist, as a body worker, in a really clinical setting, and also taught a little bit here and there, and actually taught anatomy to body workers at one point. So I have some background in this. So if I'm geeking out on this stuff a little bit, that's why. If some of the content feels a little dry, stick with it because there's some really awesome stuff here. But again, you know, we are using some jargon from a really specific world. So give us a few minutes as we get going, and then we get into some interesting ideas around why humans started walking, around persistence hunting and some of the early developments there. He's going to point you to some resources if you want to go deeper into this stuff. So without any more of me talking, I give you James Earls of Born to Walk.
James Earls is a writer, lecturer, and body worker specializing in myofascial release and structural integration. Increasing the understanding and practice of manual therapy has been a passion of James's since he first started practicing bodywork over 20 years ago. Throughout his career, James has traveled widely to learn from the best educators in his field, including Thomas Myers, developer of the Anatomy Trains concept. And we're going to talk more about that concept if you haven't heard of it before. James and Tom's founded the Kinesis UK, which coordinates Anatomy Trains and Kinesis Myofascial Integration Training throughout Europe. James is now involved in a number of projects involving research into fascia, movement, and treatment modalities. He is also the founder and director of Ultimate Massage Solutions, one of UK's most prestigious providers of professional literature and workshops in the field of bodywork. James is also the author of the book Born to Walk, and that's how I first found him. James, welcome to the show.
Hi, Daniel. Thank you very much. Thank you for the invite, and thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on. I'm really excited to have you here, and I'm really excited for the work that you've done and to make sure that we cross-pollinate our two communities here, because I feel like you're bringing a lot of information that's really important to the rewilding community for sure. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and some of the stuff that I read in your intro? Catch us up a little bit on who you are and how you came here.
Sure. I'm originally from a little town just south of Belfast in Northern Ireland. Compared to not Belfast in Maine. So I grew up during the 70s and 80s in Northern Ireland, during the what we euphemistically called the Troubles back then. And I studied psychology at university, and I think that was probably the media studies of its time. It was kind of, I didn't know what the heck I want to do with my life, so let's do another 3 years of education. And I finished that and still didn't quite know, so I did a couple of years of voluntary work at a peace and reconciliation centre. And while I was there, I got my appetite whetted for aromatherapy, massage therapy, and a lot of just natural healing approaches. And we at the center, we were working with people that had quite stressed backgrounds, either affected by the conflict that was going on or by physical abuse, alcohol abuse, even sexual abuse within their families and communities. So I did a lot of experimentation of just ways in which we could just give people a little bit of space to kind of switch off and hopefully come back to in contact with themselves a little bit more cleanly. So I was back in the early 90s, and thankfully I found my direction and decided to train in aromatherapy. And I set up a little clinic in Belfast and was quite happily working away with, you know, various interesting results. And then eventually in the kind of mid to late 90s, I came across the work of Thomas Myers, and he was writing a series of articles for a massage magazine. And he was the first person that I found that actually explained anatomy. I had been taught anatomy many times, and I don't know if many of your listeners have kind of suffered through anatomy lectures, but I think it's a common experience. But just the way that Tom's articles kind of put things into context of the interactions between the architecture of the bones, the alignment of the muscle fibers and so forth. So I got quite excited by his work, and I was collecting a series of articles. And then thankfully in 1999, there was just in the same science magazine a little advert saying he was coming to Dublin to talk about this thing called anatomy trains. And I had never heard of anatomy trains, but I liked the way that he described and worked with anatomy. So I thought, well, it's worth a gamble. And I got on train, went on to Dublin, and I was just kind of blown away over the following 3 days of just his big picture, the way that he brought so many different strands of life together. And by no means did I understand exactly what he was talking about, but I could see that he knew what he was talking about, and I kind of aspired to even have a little fraction of that. So I trained with him, I kind of signed up and started commuting between Belfast and Boston over the next couple of years, and that was in 2001. I qualified in structural integration, and Tom and I have been working together pretty much ever since. So,
you know, it's funny. I just took down off my wall, but they've been up for over a year, all of those Anatomy Trains posters. And when I say on my wall, I mean in like that's in my like living room kitchen. It's like I live in a kind of an open concept, but they've been on my walls for a long time because just having them in the background has helped me to integrate a deeper understanding. For the listeners, if you're not familiar with this idea of anatomy trains, I really want to encourage you to get out there and look at it. I remember that same period of time, James, that you're talking about when his early articles were coming out, and I was teaching some anatomy at the time and being like, okay, there's a deeper level here. And there was this excitement I felt, sounds like you felt too, because I think that for the average person, they assume, oh, anatomy, I mean, my God, we've got that figured out. That's like all the parts of the body. We've got all that labeled. And it's like, wait, there's a whole system of the body that hasn't even been looked at yet. And that's that kind of fascial component. Do you agree with that statement? And also, could you say a little bit more about the fascial system? Because I think people assume we've labeled all the parts already.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very true. And I think we've got a much better picture over the last 10 years. I don't know if Tom's writings was responsible or whether it was just good timing, that it came along at the time. I think the timing was just right to talk about the fascial tissue, because we had, I think, an increasing frustration at the anatomy of the parts. It's a very sophisticated model that we've had of labeling each of the bits, but there's something very unsatisfactory at the same time, because whenever you look at human and also animal movement, we really see an integrated, complete body moving. That's not just the accumulation of individual bits. And you know, Tom's model of the anatomy trains helps to give us a visualization of how that kind of works. So as you mentioned, the fascial system is probably best seen, kind of thinking back to any time that you've handled, and sorry for any vegetarians among you, but any time you've handled raw meat, it's that silvery kind of film that surrounds each piece of meat that you're working with. And what people hadn't really realized up until that it's become more popular over the last 10 or 15 years, what people hadn't realized was that silvery kind of collagenous, fibrous film is a continuing connecting elements throughout the whole body. It doesn't have the so-called attachments and points of origin and insertion that we talk about in anatomy. It just keeps on going from one bit into another. So it's the bit that's connecting and holding all of our body together. And so I think we've really kind of got a better appreciation of its roles over the last, especially the last 10 years, I guess.
Yeah, it almost seems like people assume that stuff, or they assumed for a long time, it was like you get a box, a package in the mail, you open it up to try to find whatever you've bought, and you've got all those packing peanuts in there or whatever. So you pull all that stuff out and you go like, okay, here's the thing I'm after. And it's like, we've done that with anatomy, right? Because I think we've all seen those charts of the musculoskeletal anatomy. And what people don't realize is that what's been cut away is all of that fascia, all that silvery stuff, as if it was just packing peanuts. And turns out, actually, that might be the really important stuff, eh?
Yeah. That was a wonderful analogy. Thank you. It was the stuff that was just kind of cut out and thrown away. It was the grey, uninteresting stuff. It was seen as being quite passive. It's not an organ in and of its probably of its own right. It doesn't produce the endocrine elements. It wasn't seen to be actively contractile in the way that the muscle fibers are. But it's really important in the fact that it holds everything together. It allows transfer of force. It does have an ability to actually contract, but it's on a much smaller level than the muscle fibers. And it's a very important element within our protective and immune system. So it has I think it's multifactorial and really quite exciting. And it's unfortunate that it's been ignored over the last 2,000 years of anatomy. So,
yeah, I noticed this thing. I really love like looking at Leonardo's old drawings of the human anatomy. And I know that, you know, he was in a really limited world then because obviously I think it was fairly illegal what he was doing looking at cadavers. But there's this theme through history where we always compare our bodies to the dominant technology of the time or whatever. So you look at those and you see Leonardo using this rope and pulley model. You know, the muscles are ropes and the joints are like pulleys or levers or whatever. And then we see this model, I think, of in our time of the idea of the body as a car, and everybody's talking about, oh, we put the fuel in and we burn the fuel like an engine. And that in that model, we talk about our body parts like car parts, which are interchangeable, which do have definite ends, which can be replaced without having to replace a whole chain or train of parts. And so we assume the body's like that. And then it's like we've just skipped right to, oh, now the body's a computer. And we've missed this part that talks about the tensegrity model of the body. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And where's that going? And is that being understood and embraced in the mainstream yet?
The idea of tensegrity is, I suppose, the best way to explain it was for me, looking back to the few lectures that I had on the skeletal system. Sorry, my other English sometimes. And sometimes then I remember
I kinda
how
like
good
it.
American.
Skeletal. I've never actually heard skeletal. That. I like that.
Yeah. So over here we say skeletal sometimes.
Cool. You're welcome to say that on the show. I like it.
Okay. Thanks. So sometimes when you talk about the skeletal system, we talk about the properties of the each system, and something, you know, the properties of the skeletal system would be for protection. So our skull helps protect our brains, and you know the bone marrow helps produce red blood cells, and also then for support. The skeleton is the kind of framework that holds everything together. And you know, whenever I was first learning my anatomy, I'm going, okay, yep, I get that. And then move on to the next system, and we talk about the endocrine system or the respiratory system. And then it's not until kind of thinking about it that actually, you know, that there's nothing actually holding that skeleton together other than the skeleton that's standing in the front of the room, other than, well, all of the wires and the screws and so forth.
Oh, like the guy on the wheels in the classroom you're talking about.
Yeah, it's almost
yeah, he's pinned together.
it's the law that, you know, that skeleton is that has to be at the front of every anatomy room. You know, it has to be there, and it's always held but together with that aluminium rod that goes up the backside and up through the spine, and it's got all of those wires. But it's the same in our body, in that we need something else to actually hold the skeleton in place, and that would be the for us the myofascial system, that is the interaction between the muscles and this fascial tissue that we've been already talking about. That the skeletal system requires some tensional elements. So it needs the contractile tissue of the muscles and they need to have some tone in order to maintain the kind of a space and integrity within the rest of the skeletal system. So you kind of pertaining to some of the different ways in which we've looked at the body, and you know, the predominant model of the last couple of few hundred years has been a very systems approach. And really, you know, there's a usefulness in seeing that, but actually it's no system is going to have its own longevity outside or independent from the rest of the other systems. So really, whenever looking at the body, we need to talk about the neuromyofascial, skeletal, endocrine, respiratory, urinary, what, you know, keep on going, yeah, kind of system. So the idea of tensegrity is the balance between the hard tissue of the skeleton and the tensional elements that would be the neuromyofascial element. So it's the muscle tissue along with that fibrous and silvery film that we talked about, and its tone that's kind of provided or set and adjusted constantly by the nervous system. So all of that is helping us to hold and hang together and be able to respond to the different demands of our movement requirements.
And the whole thing kind of props us up, right? I think I kind of picture, you know, and I still hear it. If I walk into a gym today, I hear the trainers in there telling people, you know, your knees over your ankles and your hips over your knees and your shoulders over your that. And this is this whole idea that you're a stack of bricks. But yeah, but it seems to me more like when I put a backpacking tent up and none of those poles actually touch each other. In other words, none of those bones actually touch each other, but the whole tent pops open when I get that last pole in. And even if I flip the tent upside down on its head, it still stays suspended open. And here we are walking around in this skeleton that kind of stays suspended open, but we're told, no, it's gravity stacking blocks on top of each other. It seems like that's still a pretty dominant belief out there, right?
It is, and it's I think it's because it's easy and probably it's had some longevity. It's built on our understanding from the past. And the idea of tensegrity is a little bit different and more challenging. It hasn't settled in to our consciousness as yet. So there are, I think, useful elements of the alignment with gravity. It does create a little bit more ease within our system. But as you say, that our bodies will exist and they will have integrity independent of our alignment with gravity, or you know, whether we're at sea level, whether we're at 3,000 feet above sea level, or you know, if we're in the International Space Station, our bodies will still maintain their integrity. They're not reliant on gravity and the pressure that's around, and that's because of the tensional elements that are being balanced by those compressional elements of the skeleton. I know. I'm trying. Yes. Yeah.
You know, you said something earlier when we were talking just before the call. You said that, you know, you've always had a passion, or you got really interested in archaeology and human origins. And I'd love to hear a little bit about that and how that interfaces with the work you're doing now. Obviously, a huge passion of ours on this show is trying to, not just the archaeology, but how we integrate that into our bigger worldview and understanding of our ancestry and our origins. And just kind of curious how that relates. And actually, I want to stack, I know this is probably annoying, but I want to stack another question on that.
Sure.
And it's that, and I've been asking a lot of people this, and I've still not got a satisfactory response from anybody, but I watch my dog, you know, my sort of dog companion, lay on the floor for 4 or 5 hours, and then somebody pulls into my driveway and she is up on her feet and racing out the door at her full speed. Her connective tissue is so relaxed that I never see her injure herself. And then I watch animals outside that are in a wild state, like a squirrel or a bird, perform these physical feats that most of us just would feel, I feel like we would tear apart, and our structural system can't handle it. Now, I know we're not dogs and I know we're not squirrels or birds, but what's going on with us today? And do you think ancestrally human beings had a kind of structural integration that made them more like the other animals?
It's a great question. So I think, yeah, we also have to compare like to like. So I think we have escaped many of the pressures of evolution through better hygiene and sanitation and better, somewhat better diet, and certainly, and this is probably a two-way sword, more access to calories. Calories are cheaper and more easily achieved. And so we are living beyond what was previously a kind of a natural lifespan. Cellularly, we are able to live to 80 to 120, but we probably didn't do that whenever we were evolving. So, our natural, effective, active lifespan was probably up to in around 35, 40. And unfortunately, not being over 40, you feel that change and kind of in physicality. It's like, okay, my body's certainly not as resilient as it once was. Compared to the animals that still have a shorter lifespan and are not living with probably a mental, psychological, societal override of our natural instincts. I hated school.
Sit still 8 hours.
Yes, I remember one of my earliest memories is of my brother coming home. He was 5 years older than me, and he came home from what we call primary school, I think it's elementary school for you, with the letter for the younger sibling who was ready to go to school the next year, and giving it to my mother, and my mother telling me what it was, and realizing, oh my God, I'm going to prison next year. Necessarily verbalized it or thought of it in that way, but I knew that this was not going to be a good thing. So we're taking hugely, brilliantly active, kind of explorative kids at 4 to 6 years old, and expecting them to sit pretty much still for 5, 6, 7 hours a day, and do things that they're not necessarily inclined to do, and then that socializes us into being able to work from 9 to 5 or even beyond. And again, I grew up in the 70s, so I got frustrated. Thinking back, I get frustrated with it. I kind of grew up with the promise of the 2 or 3 day working week, and whenever I grew up, it was like, yeah, oh, life was going to be so good because we'd
all
have
getting
these
better.
Yeah, and actually, no, we're working longer hours, and we're getting more and more sedentary. Right. So I think we're very much. I'm sure you've spoken to it many times. We're just in this mismatch of our bodies and our environment. We did not evolve in order to sit in chairs and stare at computer screens and drive commutes for anything up to 3 or 4 hours a day. I live in London now, and so many people are just doing these mad commutes and just sitting there getting frustrated in car jams, and
not to mention they go from the car back into the house or into the office where they sit more. I mean, it's like kind of a hurry up and get there so you could sit, sit there while you try to get there and sit. It's just like an always sitting.
Yep. So we're sitting, we're being less active, we're probably just weakening ourselves in many ways compared to your dog, who's eating, I presume, a relatively natural diet for itself, and not consuming ice cream and soft drinks and all the other rubbish that we tend to put down our throats.
Yeah, I'm jealous of my dog's diet.
Well, sometimes when I smell it, it can have it, but yes. I would like to not have the cravings that everyone else is prone to. So we don't have the same pressures, I think.
Yeah, it's true. We are kind of doing really different stuff with our body. And then, so that kind of brings me then, do you think ancestrally though, so if we were able to go back, let's say pre Neolithic revolution, pre-agriculture, and we're looking at hunter-gatherers around the world from kind of anywhere, any locale. You think we would see? I mean, because you said earlier, like, we kind of got to compare like to like, and so that makes me right away go to chimpanzees and bonobos or orangutans or gorillas, or who we share a lot of genetic material with, and we do, you know, come from that lineage. And again, the way they move is just like a chimpanzee. I mean, that's about as close as we're going to get to a Homo sapien, I guess, in nature right now. And man, the way they move is just incredible. And I agree with what you said before. It's like they're not living out a kind of double lifespan or anything like that. But but wow, do they have a movement? Do you think Homo sapiens have a movement capacity like that?
I think we chose a slightly different path. For me, one of the big questions was bipedalism. Why did we stand up? And when we compare a lot of our anatomy to the chimpanzee, there's a lot of important physiological differences, which, you know, I don't fully understand and haven't explored because chemistry is not my thing. They have a different muscle physiology, you know, pound for pound, their muscle is stronger than ours. So that gives them all of that explosive power that we don't have. But I think, and maybe coming back to some of the themes within the book, Born to Walk, what we chose, you know, not consciously, but just with the path of evolution, we chose a more elastic rather than a muscle-based strategy. To me, we're efficient chimpanzee rather than the kind of muscularly expensive strategy. So looking at muscle power compared to kind of the use of the elastic energy that we seem to have.
Okay, that's really cool. I get that. All right, let's explore that a little bit. And before we go into this elasticity and this elastic tissue idea, I want to talk a little bit about bipedalism, because I feel like we're at this this is a juicy thing to talk about here. So there's a lot of things that separate human beings from the other wild creatures of the planet. And I know people have spent a lot of time trying to figure out what it is that makes us different. So we hear things about our brain. We hear things about our thumbs. We hear things about our ability to produce fire and make tools and all these things. But bipedalism is a pretty uniquely human trait, especially amongst the primates, or the kind of extended bipedalism we do. I'm curious how you first got interested in that, and what, as you dove into the, I mean, just for the listeners, and so you know, the book Born to Walk, James's book, is a very deep treatise on how walking actually works. And if you think it's a just simple idea, pick up the book and be prepared to be shocked and amazed at just how deeply he's taken the topic. But, you know, and we were talking, James, before the show, I just want to clue everybody in on this, is I loved the book Born to Run, and I loved everything that came out of it, and I ended up Google searching Born to Walk just to see if anybody had looked at that, because I thought, well, we're not really born to run, we're born to walk. And that's how I arrived at James's book. But James, tell us a little bit about, you know, how you got interested in bipedalism and what you've uncovered as you've studied it more.
Sure. It's archaeology and evolution had always been an interest, and I mentioned studying psychology, and my first year at university, I did a few other courses. I had to do four modules, and psychology only offered one. So I got a lot of evolution from different kind of viewpoints, whether from philosophy and archaeology, and obviously psychology and animal psychology and animal development. So I'd always had a little bit of that interest as a hobby, and whenever studying with Tom, we had with the anatomy twins, which is his model of myofascial continuities. So he's kind of mapped out the ways in which that connective tissue runs through the body. So it goes at certain depths in consistent directions, and we use it very much as a model and as a way of accessing into people's structure and changing the way that they stand, so working with their posture. And we'd been doing that. I'd been working with him for over the last, probably the first 10 years. And it was it was useful. It's a wonderful model, but it always kind of struck me as why. The question is not that they are, whether they're there or not. It was also why. Is why do we have them? Why
do we have these anatomy trains, you mean? Why do we have these continuities? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it wasn't until I started looking at a lot more at kind of one of the newer current trendy kind of approaches, looking at functional anatomy and seeing that the patterns, consistent patterns in the way that we move, and being able to put the joints and the bone movements together, I started seeing that actually, well, we seem to choose, because of our bony alignments, to move and progress into these lines. So very simple one would be that the kind of the extension that we would have in that position just before we toe off or push off. So it's, you know, for the listeners, if you're thinking about walking, it's that moment where your back leg is just about to leave the ground. And whenever we look at that and we look at somebody who's walking, you know, gracefully, efficiently, you know, just nicely, there's a consistent extension, kind of a back bend through the whole of their body. And that kind of engages what, in Tom's language, he would refer to as the superficial front line. And so that would be everything from the sternocleidomastoid, one of the neck muscles, down through the stuff in front of the sternum into rectus abdominis, the kind of the six-pack muscle, into the rectus femoris, one of the quadriceps, and right down into some of the leg and foot muscles. They're all consistently tensioned at that moment. And it's not just the muscles, but it's also that elastic connective tissue. It gets stretched. It captures some of the energy of your momentum, and then it gets released as soon as you toe off. So for me, it was putting the anatomy trends into context of our movement, and then going back to that. That question of, you know, it's probably one of the most consistently asked questions of why the heck do we stand up? It just seems like such a bizarre thing to do. Why go from the stability of four points of contact to just two? It seems like we've got a very wobbly kind of structure on two points of contact, and when we walk, we only have one base of support. So that seems weird compared to the stability and all of the ease that you mentioned, the chimpanzees, that they seem to have. So it's a difficult question to answer. And I think part of it, I think, comes down to our anatomy, and that has required a different understanding of how we are put together, because it's not explained by the anatomy of parts.
Yeah. So you're kind of saying that when we decided to go from quadrupedalism, and when we look at chimps, obviously they're capable of some short duration of bipedalism, but it's not what they do, right? And they brachiate much more than we do, right? So they're swinging through trees and using all this, and a lot of energy expenditure in order to do that. But you're saying that we figured out kind of a way to optimize these long chains or trains of myofascia to, I guess, sort of increase efficiency and harness some of the elasticity of our body so that we could go, what, more distance with less work? Does that sound right?
Absolutely. Yep. You summarized it perfectly. I suppose for me, one of the easiest ways to try and explain or to maybe remember the difference would be comparing the last time you went to a museum and to the last time you went for a long walk along a canal or a flat riverbank, or
we're in the U.S. here, James. Come on, we have canals. Malls, buddy. We have malls.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm just kidding.
So maybe if you decide to go through the mall back and forth without actually going shopping, we have different styles of movement. Even sometimes we talk about museum walking. Museum walking is very kind of stop and start. You kind of, you go, you look at one exhibit, and then you kind of, you know, you move to, you know, three or four steps, you look at the next one. And generally after, you know, after, I don't know about you, but maybe after 15, 20 minutes, I'm tired and probably bored as well. But you know, it's different work to the time that we can get outside and kind of on a relatively flat surface, and we kind of stride in out, and we can quite happily just go for a walk for 5, 6, 7 miles, and you know, still feel relatively fresh at the end of it. And those are, they're different mechanisms that are being utilized within the in the body. So the museum walking is very much about the active contraction, relaxation of the muscles, and that requires a lot of calorie usage. So it requires a lot of energy. Whereas whenever we really kind of stride out, whenever we can go into that extension, and there are many other positions, but that extension that we mentioned before of prior to toe off, that actually we've help to stretch some of that fascial tissue, and it's that stretch that's just created through the momentum. It's kind of like a simplification would be, it's like stretching an elastic band. So just the momentum of the movement stretches that elastic band, and then as soon as you roll off your toes, that elastic band just kind of snaps through, right. And that lets the leg swing through.
All right, I'm starting to geek out on this. I think I'm getting the picture now. So you're saying, like, when we do a long, consistent walk, every step we're taking, we are utilizing the stored energy in that elastic. Like it's like like we stretch it with caloric energy, but then it springs back, and that's energy we're not having to burn via calories. Versus if I start, stop. It's kind of, I mean, here I go. I'm about to commit the cardinal sin. Okay, it's like as if we're a car. If I'm if I'm driving that car in traffic, stop, start, I use a lot more fuel than if I can get it on the highway in a high gear and drive it 100 miles versus like 20 miles in the city. So similarly, you're saying that when human beings picked up, started to actually walk, this gives us the ability to cover much larger distances with relatively less or the same amount of calories, because we're utilizing stored energy in our elastic tissue versus constantly contracting to fling ourselves through the trees or crawl ourselves over terrain. Does that sound about right?
Absolutely, yes. So
that's so cool.
So that allowed us to, I presume, expand our territories. You know, we could go further. We could explore more. So we just got a different strategy for survival. You know, the territory in which we can go hunting for the calories. You know, so you mentioned Born to Run. It's this similar mechanism that allows us to go persistence hunting. We're utilizing that same kind of elastic energy. So, you know, it opens up a different way of life. We can go exploring, we can go walking that little bit further. So our horizons quite literally expand.
Wow, you know, I didn't realize going into this call, James, but that this thing you're talking about is a really important piece of the puzzle of answering this question of why we're, how we got here and how we're living like this. And I didn't, thank you for that. I didn't realize that you had made quite that contribution to this piece of the anthropological, archaeological story, but it sounds so true. And when you mention about persistence hunting, you know, something that I think a lot of people have seen now, some of those videos, if you haven't, go check out some videos of the Bushmen of the Kalahari, I think is how you'd search that, doing a persistence hunt. And what you'll essentially see is that human beings can run down nearly any large animal on the planet because we have a few adaptations, like what we're talking about here with our ability to run, like our ability to sweat, like our ability to carry water. And I know that what I had first heard when I learned about persistence hunting is that because these animals couldn't sweat, they would overheat and eventually they'd have to stop, and that's when we would, you know, kill that animal and take it as a prey. But now what I understand too is that we're trying to keep that animal running in a really inefficient way so that they overproduce heat, right? So what we're doing is keeping that animal from being able to harvest its own elastic energy too when it's running. Does that sound right?
I presume so. Yes, I'm certainly no expert on persistence hunting, but yeah, if we can try and get the animal to run as if it's in a museum. So to go back to the analogy of walking it, if we can get it to keep changing direction, to change different speeds, if we can get it to sprint rather than getting it into an easy run. So, you know, we all have different gear settings. So then, you know, some people talk about that humans would have three natural gears of walk, run, and sprint. Some say that jogging is an invented gear that was allowed to us by Mr. Nike and Reebok and so forth. That's, you know, compared to the horses that have walk, trot, canter, gallop. So each of those different gears have a setting. Again, going back to the analogy of a car, it's, you know, each gear in a car has a kind of a sweet rev kind of count. So, and each, when you're in that sweet kind of range, the efficiency is good. If you're too low or too high, then you're kind of burning more petrol or gas than should be. And it's exactly the same in our bodies. So if we're walking, if we're running, if we're sprinting, we have a kind of a nice range that's going to maximize the efficiency and the elasticity. If we're running too slow or if we're running too fast, then we go back into that kind of, we have to go back into that muscular strategy. And that's where the calories and the inefficiencies come from.
Yeah, that's really, really, it's so interesting to me. It's like, if you can keep that animal sort of back and forth between two gears, it's like, it's like this constant inefficient thing. And you see how that animal would just kind of frustrate and overheat. So I would like to talk a little bit about some of these other forces involved, because you spent a bit of time in the beginning of your book talking about ground reaction force as well. And I think that's just a fascinating topic. Maybe some people listening haven't heard about. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how that interfaces with the way we locomote?
Sure. So ground reaction force, it's kind of difficult to explain without kind of touching on that F word of physics. It's the way in which the ground will, or any surface, is kind of pushing back at you. So, you know, whenever we heel strike, whenever we interact with a surface, there has to be a reaction against your force. Otherwise, you would just obviously pass through that surface. There would be, you know, it's back to one of Newton's laws of, to every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. So if I hit the floor is kind of pushing back against me, and that's important because it gives us a solidity to work with. You mentioned the idea of tensegrity and the bones kind of floating within that tensional network of the myofascial system. And so sometimes I think of the bones having their own kind of little mini trampolines. They're all suspended. They're all floating. They're not touching each other. So every time that I interact with a surface, there has to be a deceleration. I have to stop myself from falling to the floor. So I'm hoping that, you know, when I heel strike, when I, you know, go walking, my skull does not collapse and hit the ground.
right.
So I see it as every bone having a little trampoline, and it is, so it's kind of like the way that we jump on a trampoline and we just get that elongation of the springs, and then the springs just kind of help send us back up into the air again. So the ground reaction force is essential in that loading. It gives us the potential for stretching that elastic tissue of the fascia. So I hope it's a difficult concept to.
Yeah,
to
but what it is that essentially that's because you gave an analogy. I believe it's in your book. You gave an analogy about why it's so hard to walk in sand, right? Because it's like, and I used to lifeguard, you know, so we would run sometimes on the beach. We'd run every day on the beach, but sometimes down in the intertidal zone where the sand was wet, and that was so much easier to run on. And then sometimes up in the soft sand, and it's grueling to go, you know, even 100 meters on, you see that, meters, huh? Even 100 meters on the soft sand is so much harder than running, I don't know, a quarter mile on the wet packed sand, which kind of brings us to the crux of this whole thing we're talking about. Isn't it because it's like I can't get into a gear where I can harvest that elastic spring energy on the sand, because is it just because the sand is just diffusing that elastic energy of mine down into the ground, into itself?
Absolutely. Well, it's diffusing the energy of your foot strike. So because of the wet sand, the dry sand having a looseness, it doesn't have the solidity in order to kind of bounce back. So, you know, you will always leave a footprint in soft sand, you know, and that's because you've displaced the grains of sand beyond your foot. Whereas you'll I hope, never leave a footprint in a wooden floor. you know, maybe unless you're wearing stiletto heels or something, but I don't think that's your style. So the wooden floor will always kind of push you back. There's a solidity to it. So it doesn't absorb that energy from your foot strike, whereas the looseness of the sand just kind of dissipates all of that energy. So that's energy that's lost out of your system. So that energy then has to be kind of recuperated or kind of regained from inside your body. And so you have to go back to muscle work again. And that's why it's so exhausting to try and walk or run, and especially running on loose, dry sand.
Yeah. We're almost like back in chimpanzee land again. Then
yeah.
It's like...
Yep. And yeah, we don't have the physiology, their physiology of muscle to be able to do that work.
Right. So, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Oh, that's really fascinating. Yes, because I also notice, and this is actually something that frustrates me about myself, but I like to go running, and I always think to myself, like, I should run on this soft area off the asphalt because it's going to be better for my body and it's more natural and the terrain's more interesting. But I'll find myself kind of wanting to pop up onto the asphalt very often because it's like so much easier to run on that surface. That's, I assume, why that is. And it's almost like, yeah. It's almost like you've got – so you're pushing down and you've got your elasticity, but then it's pushing back up, right? So it's almost buoying me along the surface as opposed to a soft surface, right?
Yes, yeah. So it's maybe like changing the springs on a trampoline. Mm. So sometimes if you just put ropes on a trampoline, you know, that's like going for a run on concrete. You know, there's no give. And, you know, if you put really, really soft springs onto the trampoline, that's maybe more like going on the soft sand. So there's every different surface that you're walking on, running on, is going to have a different kind of elastic spring-like setting. And each of our bodies, we have a different strength setting. You know, we can compare different bodies in terms of collagen type, or the fascial tissue is made up in slightly different ways. So we all have a different internal kind of elastic setting. And so each of us will probably be drawn to a slightly different surface that we'll find that ideal kind of sweetness where feel easy. But it's probably going to be something like asphalt, like reasonably compact earth, you know, something that's kind of solid but has a little bit of give in it.
Right. Yeah, got it. That's really helpful. Curious how you, for the people who are listening, I'm curious about any ways you'd love to see this kind of work and this thinking integrated into people's lives. Like, any kind of tips, tricks, hacks, ideas where it's like, hey, here's how you can use some of this, or any stuff that you're like, hey, you know, if you're out there walking, running, or considering getting body work or any of those kind of things, anywhere you want to point people or any suggestions you have on how they can best utilize some of the work you've done and the things you've talked about?
Sure. There's a wonderful guy that I've done some work with. He's a body worker and also a researcher. A guy called Robert Slipe, and he's developed what he calls a fascial fitness, where he uses a lot of kind of rebounding. It's kind of like plyometrics, but without the explosiveness of plyometrics. Plyometrics was maybe popular back in the 80s or so, but it got a bad name because people were doing it too hard, too fast. So it's kind of, you know, it's maybe playing a little bit with some of the exercises that we do naturally.
And that's Robert Slype, S-L-Y-P-E. How do you spell?
He's German, so it's okay. S-C-H-L-I-E-P.
Great, and we'll put that in the show notes as well for people.
Yep. So a really interesting guy if you're into the anatomy and into the detail of the connective tissue. He's done a lot of very exciting, interesting work. So he's using a lot of kind of rebounding, recoil kind of things. So that, and really thinking about long chain movements. So it's, I think, really important that we start to recognize the importance of the interrelationships. One of the things that I talk about in the book is the idea of the essential events. In order to get to that position of extension prior to toe off, that actually requires a lot of things to happen through each joint. So I need toe extension, I need ankle dorsiflexion and plantar flexion, I need knee extension, hip extension, lumbar extension, thoracic extension. So all of the body needs to work together. And so sometimes we get drawn into, oh, my hip hurts, for example. It's like, oh, so you go to a body worker or a therapist of any time and you kind of go, my hip hurts. And we get drawn to working on the hip or stretching out the hip without realizing that actually maybe their hip hurts because it's having to do more work because your toe doesn't extend or your knee doesn't extend or, you know, there's something funky with your low back. So it's looking at the other areas that maybe aren't as productive or aren't as cooperative as they could be. So I think we're moving into a new era of getting that more connected anatomy. It's like, oh, okay, my hip is dependent upon my toes. My toes kind of dependent upon my low back, you know. So it's kind of thinking a little bit, not necessarily outside the box, but I'm certainly wider than the traditional anatomy box anyway.
And the current box. Yes. I think it's so funny when you start to get a handle on this stuff because all these new agey hippie things like, oh, it's all connected, man. It's like, no, it actually is all connected. Yes. It really actually is all connected. That's so cool.
Yeah.
Where do people learn more about your work? Where do you like to send people to get a copy of your book and any other kind of resources or places you want to point people to get more access to you or the people you work with?
Sure. In the US we have anatomytrains.com. That's just anatomy and trains, just nice and locomotion. .com. And they'll get directly to the work of Thomas Myers and his many teachers through North America. And he also has a store there, so he's got a lot of really interesting resources. And he's selling, obviously, his book, Anatomy Trains, if you want one of the original sources. And then also Born to Walk, my book. So he would be kind of responsible for US and the rest of the Americas and where I am over in UK and Europe. It would be anatomytrains.co.uk, and that again gives you access to our listings of workshops and also the product listings. So we have different DVDs and books and I think we have a workshop near you, I'm sure.
And curious also, just I guess in closing, what you've got on the horizon, what you're excited about moving forward into the future, and what we should kind of be looking out for from you. What's got you excited now?
At the minute, it's really what I'm looking at is trying to put together a healthy way of exercising and really getting all of those essential events tied in together. So can we kind of combine the foam rolling ideas, the bodywork ideas, the exercise and stretching ideas? And so I'm hopefully putting that together into a book and maybe even a DVD. So that should be coming out within the next, I have to commit myself to within the next 18 months or so. Yeah. So it's really kind of trying to bring all of these disparate stories together and say, you know, can we get one kind of unifying approach and blend, taking the best from each of those. And
yeah. I'll be curious what you call that. Well, I'll just be curious what you call it, because earlier you were kind of mentioning something about you know, all the different parts versus a more total view. And it's like the word holistic is such a great word, but it's like it got so kind of played out, you know. It's like,
yeah,
it's like, oh man, I wish they had saved that word for when there was actually a holistic approach, because now it's no good, you know. But it'll be exciting to see what you come up with, and let us know when it's out, and come on back on the show if you want to promote that when it's happening, and just know you've got a community of people here to support you in any way we can, man.
Well, thank you very much, Daniel. That's lovely to hear. So yeah, it's been lovely speaking with you, and thanks very much for your support. And yeah, I hope to you know, we'll be in contact again soon.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming on. We really appreciate your time, man. Well, you've been listening to James Earls, author of Born to Walk. Check out his book, and we'll put all those resources that he mentioned in the show in the show note. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to the show. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe to the show on iTunes. And if you would, leave a rating and a review. That's really going to help us get this message out to more people. And it's going to help us know what you really like and what you don't like, and help us really tailor this show to your needs and to what you want to hear. Please stay connected with me at danielvitalis.com and sign up for my newsletter and my magazine, Rewild Yourself. And you can subscribe to both of those right there on danielvitalis.com. Got lots of really great shows lined up, and I'm going to keep bringing you more great information. And until then, keep rewilding yourself. Show you.